If American whistleblowers are shut down, how do we find out the truth?
The sense of the government of being entitled to conceal what it's doing from the American public is very strong.
The need for government transparency and a look at two historic Supreme Court decisions. I'm Susan Barnett, and this is 51%, The Women's Perspective. A decade ago, whistleblowers who brought the Enron scandal and the mishandling of intelligence prior to the 9/11 attacks to light were hailed as heroes. Today, Bradley Manning is on trial facing possible execution for leaking documents about the U.S. torture of prisoners. Edward Snowden faced an international manhunt after handing a reporter documentation of U.S. surveillance of international leaders and U.S. citizens' communications. Beatrice Edwards is Executive Director and International Programs Director for GAP, the Government Accountability Project. GAP focuses on supporting citizen activists and protecting whistleblowers.
In a way, I think that the conflict has become more aggravated, and so the stakes are higher and the penalties are more severe. And partly that is because the disclosures are more important. And I can explain that by saying, in part, it's a commentary on a lot of things that have happened politically and economically. And one of those things is that, I mean, in the old days when we got a whistleblower, you would hear a disclosure that someone was embezzling money or funds or resources and procurement, and something needed to be done. Now, in a case like that, the institution has an interest that is convergent with the interest of the whistleblower. That is, both the reporting employee and the company he or she works for want to shut down that kind of misconduct. There is some reluctance, perhaps, on the part of the corporation because it's an embarrassment that their internal controls have failed. But generally speaking, they don't want somebody embezzling in procurement. Now, a lot of the whistleblowing disclosures that we get at the Government Accountability Project are systemic fraud. That is, they're ruinous for the institution. So we get banking whistleblowers who say that a major financial institution they work for is in the business of promoting some subprime mortgages and selling pools of these securities to investors, knowing that the mortgages are going to go into foreclosure, that there's a fraud that goes right through the system of the institution. And that's what you see also with Manning and with Snowden. Manning is reporting on gross, widespread human rights violations in the way America conducts its wars. And so the institution has got to shut down the whistleblower and conceal the disclosure if the armed forces in that case are going to be able to maintain their reputation with the public.
Almost immediately after the Snowden story broke, two politicians, Dianne Feinstein and Robert Menendez, both came out and said that Snowden is not a whistleblower. By definition, they said a whistleblower stays and takes the consequences.
No, there's a legal definition of a whistleblower. A whistleblower is someone who reports on activities or conduct he or she reasonably believes to be illegal or to be gross waste, fraud, or abuse of authority. Now, in the law that applies in the United States, there are two parts to the law. One is, what's the scope of the definition? And that's the scope. Anyone who reports on something he or she believes is illegal or is waste or abuse of authority. Then there's the part of the law that extends protection from retaliation. And the U.S. Congress, when they passed the latest incarnation of whistleblower protections, which is the Whistleblower Protection Enhancement Act for federal employees in November 2012, stripped protections for intelligence agency employees out of the provision that provides protection from retaliation. So Snowden is, under the law, a whistleblower, but he has no protection. And now what we would say to someone like Feinstein is, if you are going to define someone as not a whistleblower because they have no protection from retaliation, that's equivalent to saying there's no such thing as a whistleblower in Russia or China or Cameroon or Moldova because there are no protections there.
These raise ethical issues. Individual moral judgments have to be made. I mean, when I heard about the Snowden case and the fact that he said he had taken the job with the hopes of being able to document abuses that he knew were happening, I immediately felt like that negated something of what he had to say. And yet, I realized that if it was an animal rights activist getting a job at a factory farm in hopes of documenting abuses they knew were happening there, I wouldn't have an issue with that. So these are cases where we have to actually really consider how we feel about these ethical choices.
Well, to the extent that that legislation in some way, directly or indirectly, reflects the prevailing opinion of the American public, the reasons why Snowden took the job are irrelevant to the designation of him as a whistleblower. The only part of his attitude toward what he disclosed that is relevant to defining him as a whistleblower is whether or not he reasonably believed that what he was saying was true. So if you're lying or if you're fabricating things for malicious purposes, you can't claim the title whistleblower. But if what you're saying, what you're disclosing is true, as in the case, in the hypothetical case of your animal rights activist, then you're still a whistleblower. Whatever the reason is, whatever your personal reason is for doing what you do, that is legally irrelevant.
And so what you're describing is a government that really wants to keep its secrets.
That seems to be the pervasive message of the government, because we were talking about it around here in doing some of the research into what the NSA has been doing as a context around Snowden's disclosures. We found that the Director of National Intelligence, James Clapper, appeared before Dianne Feinstein's committee, the Senate Intelligence Committee, and one of the senators asked him if the NSA was collecting data, digital data, on American citizens, and he said, not deliberately and not, I can't remember the exact wording, but essentially, he deliberately misled the Senate. He lied about what the NSA was doing. And there's been no mention of any sanction for him for having done that. And yet Snowden told the truth about it and has inspired this international manhunt on the part of the government. So the sense of the government of being entitled to conceal what it's doing from the American public is very strong, even when what it's doing is on its face unconstitutional. The new dimensions to this is the battle over information, because there's now so much information, and it's valuable both from an economic point of view and from a national security point of view. And so you see some of the forces of national security and commercial interests trying to keep control of that information, and then a few anti-secrecy advocates like Edward Snowden trying to at least expose enough of it to make it possible for the public to consider debating where the line should be between private and public information.
So with an organization called the Government Accountability Project and a government that wants to keep its secrets, your hands must be very full these days.
We do, and we get busier and busier because in the United States we've deregulated more and more of our economy so that the only voice for the public interest in aviation, in telecommunications, in food production, in national security, in banking, is the whistleblower. And now we see the government trying to withdraw protections from retaliation that legally should extend to whistleblowers so that we lose that last voice of public interest on the inside of industries that really matter.
Beatrice Edwards is Executive Director and International Programs Director for GAP, the Government Accountability Project. Up next, a look at what was the Voting Rights Act and a movie that explores discrimination against a group that until this summer wasn't entitled to married rights under federal law. If you missed part of this show or want to share it with others, visit the 51% archives at WAMC.org. This week's show is number 1254. In June, the Supreme Court ruled 5-4 to strike down key requirements of the Voting Rights Act, opening the door for states to change their election laws without federal approval. Those in favor say the legislation didn't reflect contemporary reality. Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg, in a rare and very public dissent from the bench, said that the decision was a disservice to justice. Other critics described the ruling as cutting the heart out of legislation that has helped ensure equal access to the polls. In 1966, a young mother traveled from New York City to Alabama to document the lives of ordinary people in the aftermath of the voting rights struggle. She wasn't a journalist, she just wanted to go. Charmian Redding discovered people living in tents. Plantation owners had evicted African Americans from their homes in retaliation for registering to vote. One of her photos is on permanent display at a Park Service Visitor Center exhibit along the National Historic Trail in Lowndes County, Alabama. Producer Kezia Simister interviewed Redding in her New York City home.
Some react violently when they're angry. Others channel their anger into the arts, and still others take to the streets. Charmian Redding grabbed her camera.
I think it was just a reaction to things that I thought I found so utterly cruel that they had to be recorded.
Charmian's dark hair falls to the middle of her neck. She wears a photographer's loop like a favorite necklace, and her eyes are the color of a tropical ocean. They even glisten like the surface of water. We sit together at a dark wood coffee table. Stacks of photos from our trips to Alabama and Mississippi are arranged in three piles on the table, one for each trip.
Almost everybody I met in the South throughout my three trips were people who had been thrown off plantations and were borrowing houses from people who were giving them a low rent price or no rent. They had nothing. You know, they had no furniture, no money, no jobs. And if they could, in fact, vote, it meant that they could in some way influence the government that they were living under. There's a certain amount of rage that just rises up in you when you understand how difficult these people were making it for black people to become full human beings.
Everybody that I want.
One group that I met in Alabama was living on a piece of land that had been bought by a black farmer. He allowed three or four families to come and move into tents on his land when this wave of throwing people off the plantations happened. There was one, what was called a tent city, that we visited where somebody was very pregnant. She was 17.
On May 4th, 1966, Charmian Redding stood inside a tent in Greene County, Alabama. She didn't use a flash at the time, and so she asked if she could open the tent door so she could let enough light in to take a photo.
In the picture, the mother is not looking at me. And as I recall, looking at her fingers as though she was wishing there was something she could do. The young girl looks sort of expecting a baby, but sort of reasonably happy. I mean, not happy, but anticipating having the baby. And the cousin, who was younger than she was, I think, is the only one that's smiling in the photograph. To me, the picture is full of foreboding. I mean, it's a picture that looks full of hope, and what you realize is these people are very far from being able to solve all their problems. When I came home, I heard that she had died. They wrote me a letter and said that she had actually bled to death because they couldn't get her to the hospital in time. I don't believe the baby survived either. They had no phone, you know, and there was no address to write to them or anything like that. There was no way to get in touch with them after I left. I've always wanted to go back, you know, and look up these people. I've never been able to do it.
Charmian Redding is now 75 years old. She lives on the Upper West Side of Manhattan in the same apartment where she raised two of her four daughters. Photographs of her children and grandchildren cover the walls and hang nearby her photos of Robert Kennedy and Fannie Lou Hamer.
I have four daughters who are, I think, very... well-rounded human beings. I thought it was important for them to have the country different, you know, to have this change come about in this country.
Charmian Redding's photograph is on display at the Tent City Interpretive Center along the Selma to Montgomery National Historic Trail in Whitehall, Alabama. The center is located on the site of one of the many tent cities. Her work has also been featured in civil rights photography books and displayed at several galleries, including the National Portrait Gallery in Washington, D.C.
The Supreme Court also made history this June with a decision striking down the Defense of Marriage Act. That means legally married same-sex couples now have access to marriage benefits once denied them under federal law. But equal rights don't happen in an instant. Dean Hamer and Joe Wilson's film, Out in the Silence, documented the firestorm that erupted when Wilson put the announcement of their wedding in his hometown newspaper. Reporter Amy Costello of Human Rights Watch has more.
Editor, common sense tells us marriage is between a man and a woman.
I am shaking with anger as I write this.
I was sick to my
stomach. Today you crossed
the
line with the announcement of the Wilson Hamer wedding.
Homosexuality is immoral.
It would be better for you not to have been born. Think about that.
Wilson decides to return home to Oil City, Pennsylvania, camera in hand, to confront some of those who oppose him. There he meets teenager C.J. Bills, who on the outside looks like a typical high school jock. Turns out C.J. is gay and has endured years of harassment for it.
This was my school. Every day when the bus stopped and I walked through that door to my locker, became 8 hours of pure hell. Kids would come by, hit me with my locker, I'd fall on the ground, my books would fly everywhere. This hall was always lovely. I'd have to walk through a crowd of kids, and there would always definitely be some tripping going on, or shoving or pushing.
What did you feel inside when that kind of stuff was happening?
Terrified. Nobody cared. None of the teachers cared, none of the administrators cared. They always gave a deaf ear and a blind eye. They watch everything. Never say a word.
Joe Wilson and Dean Hamer, co-producers and directors of Out in the Silence, what were you hoping to achieve with this film?
People have this idea that everything's great with the gay people now in the United States, but it can be very different when you're in a small conservative environment, and we want to draw attention to that and to what folks can do about it.
Life for LGBT people in rural communities and small cities and towns in the U.S., many people perhaps are increasingly comfortable with who they are and able to live somewhat openly in their communities. But there are many, many, many people who are still living in fear, in isolation, living in the shadows because of the ramifications that anti-gay, lesbian, bisexual, and transgender bigotry, harassment, and discrimination still have. And that's what we're trying to bring light to, those who are still living in the shadows.
I hate it around here. I hate it so much. I'm being threatened to have my house burnt down and stuff because I'm a faggot. It's just ridiculous. I'm tired of living like that. Confining myself into this house so I can stay alive.
Dean Hamer, as you were filming, what was going through your mind as you watched the incredible pain that this young man was facing?
I have to say it was really heartbreaking. Such a courageous, bold kid. For him to be bowed by that type of peer pressure was really saddening and frightening. It was all I could do to keep the camera from falling out of my hands.
People kept directing the question, "Are you gay?" to my face. I didn't know what to say, but I couldn't deny who I was. So I ended up saying that, you know what? Yeah. So what's it? What is it to you? Big deal. And I guess it was a big deal to everybody. I know that everybody cared because at that day everybody began to hate me. I was no longer anybody that anyone liked. Everybody hated C.J. Bills.
Welcome to American Family Focus on Pennsylvania Issues, a weekly program which discusses some of the happenings that are of concern to the family and those who hold traditional values in Pennsylvania. And now your host, Diane Gramley, State Director of American Family Association of Pennsylvania.
Observing the work of somebody like Diane Gramley back in my hometown, who puts out these very negative and dangerous messages about gay, lesbian, bisexual, and transgender people, is incredibly frustrating.
The question comes down to, should a lifestyle that will result in the destruction of traditional marriage and the natural family, not even mentioning the physical, mental, and psychological dangers to those involved in this lifestyle, be normalized and codified into the laws of the land. Those involved in this lifestyle are sinners, and they need to accept the saving grace of Jesus Christ, just like you and me.
It's frustrating because it cows local politicians, local civic leaders, etc., from doing the right thing. Because once people meet GLBT people, once allies in the community who hold viewpoints about fairness and equality start to make themselves known, that's when change occurs.
I'm Amy Costello.
That's our show for this week. Thanks to Katie Britton for production assistance. Our theme music is by Kevin Bartlett. This show is a national production of Northeast Public Radio. Our executive producer is Dr. Alan Shartok. If you'd like to hear this show again or visit the 51% archives, go to our website at wamc.org. If you'd like to connect with us on Facebook, you can find 51% there, and you can also email me at sbarnett@wamc.org. Thanks so much for joining us. We'll be back next week with another edition of 51%, The Women's Perspective.